Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, the show dedicated to discovering the jewels of wisdom used for increasing ROI for REIs. That is return on investment for real estate investors. I'm Dan Breslin, your host, and this is our 103rd episode. Before I get started, I just want to warn you that my building is under construction and you might hear some banging or clicking in the background. My apologies, there was nothing I could do about that, but it is still an audible episode. So on today's discussion, I am joined by my friend and fellow Chicago real estate investor, Andrew Holmes. Andrew operates one of the largest REIAs, the Real Estate Investor Associations in Chicago, at more than 6,000 members, and has built a rental portfolio of quality units numbering more than 180. He also flips about 20 to 30 houses per year and is the host of The Answer, a real estate radio show on AM 560. No doubt you are about to discover a few jewels of wisdom here on today's show. Let's get started, shall we? All right. Welcome to the show, Mr. Andrew Holmes. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you, man.
Cool. So just for listeners' sake, we are both Chicago real estate investors, but our show does go out across the United States. So for people who don't know you already, which is a surprise given how prevalent you are here in this market, can you give the listeners a background of maybe how you got started in real estate and what your business in real estate looks like today?
Yeah, so I got started in real estate back in college, basically. I took kind of a Pell Grant money that they give you. You're supposed to buy books with it. I bought a licensing course, real estate, you know, agent. I thought I was going to learn investing because I was going to be a real estate agent. And then I didn't know any better at the age of 19 or 20. I'm not sure how much I knew. And so that was kind of my start. Had a rough time, as most people do, as a real estate agent for the first couple of years, and then figured out how to do fairly well at it. Did pretty well as a real estate agent in terms of numbers wise, but my insecurity always was that if something happened to me, I had no income coming in if I couldn't do what I, you know, I couldn't sell houses. So at 32, which was 2008, I started doing flips. And for 2008, 2009, 2010, I purely did flips. 2008 was the first year I did, I think, 11 flips closed that year. The year after, we did close to 30 flips closed. The year after, 70 flips closed. And what I found was the real estate agent was a job, which was great. I mean, the problem is you're self-employed and you're running on the treadmill as hard as you could. And then flips worked out really well after a lot of frustration, like most people go through. But then I found myself into an even more stressful situation where I was even more stressed out doing flips. Money was good, but I just didn't want to, I wanted to get out of that mode where December was a very bad month for me because I would feel stressed that next year, how do I repeat the same thing? And more insecurity. My insecurity always was if something happened to me, what happens then? Where does the income come from? And I guess I kind of come from the old school of thought, which is I was early on as a teenager, I had a big mouth and a small brain. So I used to speak before I would think. And I told my parents that I was one day I was going to be rich. I had no idea what it meant, but and I was hell bent on proving that I could do it my way. So that was kind of the, you know, and that got me to rentals in 2011. So today we have close to 190 rental properties, 40, 45 are paid off already. And we're in the process of still buying more, accumulating more and paying them off.
You also run the Real Estate Investor Association of Chicago, REIA here, which I think has how many members now? I mean, you got to be up quite a few thousand at this point, right?
Yeah, we have about 6,000 members. We do about 12 meetings every single month. So I started that about 3.5 years ago was the start. And my frustration was that a lot of the information being provided was generic information at these RIA groups, that every time there was a sale of some sort of a guru and new ideas. And what I wanted was, I wanted more industry professionals, people who ran real estate businesses, because I approach what we do as a business. This is not a game. This is not a hobby. This is a business. So kind of that's the approach that we have taken, very heavy on information and facts. And we try to keep it as low as humanly possible on BS. And that seems to have, something seems to have worked, I guess. And then 6.5 years now, I've been doing a radio show on AM 560, The Answer, which is one of the big conservative talk show radio stations. For about 6.5 years, I've been doing a radio show on investing, talking about the same thing. How do you use real estate to build wealth? And our niche, my niche happens to be, we still do a lot of small flips, which is, I don't like to do any flip more than $350,000 back end value. That is after rehab value. So we stick to the smaller flips in our market, but a lot of repetition of the same stuff. And same thing with rentals. We stick to single families, townhouses, and 2 to 4 flats in the suburbs of Chicago.
Yeah, and we're in Chicago. Did you say how much was the flips on the ARV limit there, Andrew?
ARV limit for me is 370, 350 ideal, no higher, absolutely no higher than 450.
You and I are of the same mind there. I mean, here in Chicago, for people listening, I mean, there's, you can buy like a duplex, two flat graystone, two story, you know, brick stone structure here for anywhere from like $300,000 to $500,000 or $600,000, and put anywhere from $200,000 to $300,000 in a complete gut renovation with architectural plans, and hopefully sell that thing for $1 million plus. So when you're saying that we focus on like the low end, you and I both there at 350, 370 ARV, where I feel like it's safe and there's plenty of first time home buyers, and less risk, just to kind of give people some context of where you're coming from with that statement. So Andrew, I have a second question here I'm going to lead into, but I want you to answer first. Did you find success as a real estate agent? And if so, what did you figure out that changed your trajectory to success from the initial frustration you felt in the first couple of years?
Man, my first couple of years, I was really young. And my problem was I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was kind of deer caught in the headlights, where I got in an industry which has a very high failure rate. I didn't tell my parents. Right. And both my parents happened to be doctors, and they've done well for themselves in terms of people like self-employed people, but not well by my standards. I mean, that's just how I think. And I made all these big statements to my parents. Sometimes when you have to be careful what you say, because then you comes time to prove it. And I was not going to fail. I mean, there was just not an option for me. Whatever I had to do. So my whole business in real estate as an agent, I built on cold calls. And 6 hours a day, every day I used to do 500 dials, 100 contacts, actual talking to people, 4 to 5 appointments set. And that would turn, about 70% of them would list with me. That would turn into listings. So I met a guy by the name of Mike Ferry out of California. He's one of the biggest trainers, and he was the guru of calling for sale by owners, expireds, canceled listings. And people either absolutely adore him or can't stand him, because he is in your face and he's just an absolute taskmaster. But at that age, I mean, that's what I needed. I really needed somebody to go crazy on me, because, but what he said worked. I mean, I just followed it to the T. So it was, and my biggest reason was I would never go home. I didn't talk to my parents for a couple of years, because I was so ashamed of how badly I had, you know, I was just not cutting it. And everybody else in my family is pretty well educated. So I didn't want to get left out. I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, so that was really my motivation. So.
True enough. So did you end up getting a degree from college or just spending the grant money on the license course?
I realized years later that I had a $5,000 loan, like student loan, and every penny of it, I spent it on real estate courses, on licensing courses for real estate. I mean, I just didn't know any better, man. I mean, but I think sometimes what happens is that you keep bumbling and you keep bumbling, and life after a while quits getting in your way because you're like, this guy's not going to quit, and it leaves you alone. And then that's kind of what happened, was that I met a group of people through this particular guy, Mike Ferry, that were, I mean, just mega producers, just I mean, $1 million, $2 million GCI gross commissions earned a year. And I mean, these guys were like purebred athletes when it comes to real estate agents. And I was like, oh my God, now there are people that like think like I do. And finally I found affirmation and the confirmation that you can think big, you can think outside the box. And that exposure, it just completely changed how I think it. I mean, that my crazy dreams were possible. Maybe it'll take me time, but it was possible.
I appreciate you sharing that, Andrew, and I didn't mean to, you know, try to shed light on it or, you know, poke at you or anything like
that.
No.
I
apologize.
I wish, because that's we all go through our challenges, every one of us, you know. Somebody once said, you know, you keep your good times in your pocket and bad times in your heart. And it's great to talk about all the successes, but it's the tough times that build character. So, you know.
Yeah, I have a similar story. I was going to Villanova to get an engineering degree, and they sat us down in a big hall the first couple days, maybe a week or two when school started, my freshman year. And they said, okay, welcome to the engineering school, and here's what you can expect to make when you get done as a starting engineer. And this was 2001, and I think they told me that the starting salary was somewhere around $30,000 or $35,000. And I thought to myself, oh, God, I am in the wrong place. And I ended up, my daughter came along somewhat unplanned within that same year. And they, you know, that was kind of my reasoning for saying, oh, I have to get out and start going to make some money now. I wish I would have had such a cool thing as to spend the Pell Grant on real estate education, classes, books, whatever. I mean, that's just such a cool thing to look back and have that, especially me knowing you personally. And knowing what you've built to this day, I think that, you know, looking back, here it is. You took a certain path different than that path. And, you know, just like myself, it led to extraordinary results. I think you mentioned something, too, about these high performers through the Mike Ferry system and guys making $1 million and $2 million a year. And it's really speaks to the power of an example. You know, birds of a feather flock together. You know, when you're hanging around or when you see, even if it's not necessarily like face to face and being able to spend time with people. But I know that like myself, Andrew, I've spent time listening to a ton of podcasts, you know, radio shows, people who I have not met in person, but I've been able to look at and say, oh, wow, they did this. Look, this guy made $1 million a year. This guy made $2 million a year doing, you know, something similar to what I'm doing today. And I really encourage people to try to find people like that, just, you know, if not to spend time with them, if they're not available, but to definitely change what's believable and see some of the proof that that exists out here for us to take a look at.
No, I mean, no question, man. It changes your perspective. I mean, you know, we all have a family we come from. I think I was very blessed. I mean, all I am and I think all I could ever be with because my parents, I feel, are very blessed in that. And they put a work ethic, but they always thought work hard, study hard, and work hard and work hard and work hard, and nothing wrong with it. It's just that to go to the kind of the numbers that I had in my mind to go there, work hard works, but the multiplication factor, the duplication factor is what builds the kind of numbers that I was thinking about. I just didn't know how to put it together. And that was kind of the struggle. That sometimes the problem with entrepreneurs, with dreamers, is that most dreamers live in their own head, in their own world of fantasy. And a lot of times, I mean, they're complete disasters. It's not that they want to be that way. I think it's very tough to be practical and to have all these crazy ideas, crazy dreams, and there's a high amount of failure rate. I mean, it's just a fact of life. And that you, if you're an entrepreneur, you have to be okay understanding that. Otherwise, you're in for a ton of hurting. And I did, I mean, for the longest time, I kind of felt very poorly about myself because I couldn't figure out why I think the way I do. And I just can't help it. I mean, just, I just think outside the box and I truly think anything is possible. And then I realized I'm not very religious, but I do believe in one simple principle in life. Any dream that God puts in your head, right? It's not something that you want. Any dream that you can't sleep without is something that you have within your power to achieve. And I've come to believe that 100%. And it just works. And for some reason, I don't know why, that it just works. All you have to do is just start walking towards it, and it just, one after the other after the other, people will show up in your life. Things will happen that you least expect, and it just lines up if you're doing your part. And I mean, I don't know what you call that, but it took me, I think, till I was maybe 30, 32 years of my life to realize that it would work, and it just does. I mean, you know, so it's, that's just how it is. I think we attract a lot of stuff into our lives, you know, so that's at least my thought process.
Nice. I remember we met, I spoke at an event you happened to attend. We met out front. I think I just got my first, well, second brand new car in a long time, but my story was like starting in 2006, flipping some houses. By the time 2010 came, I was having to start over again. And then 2012, 13, 14, 15, started growing back to where we're at today, you know, in the process of, I think I have 87 contracts on the board. But I remember, you know, I pulled up in my Range Rover, my new car, and I think you saw me getting into the car. And I can't remember if you said it that night or another night, but you said something to the effect of, and this kind of paints a frustration that I've had interacting with people at RIA events and seeing people try and then fail and seeing people trying to make a better life. And you mentioned something like, man, why can't all the people who come to our RIA events go get new Range Rovers? Like, I have this vision for people to just be so successful. And you had also said something that night. I think it was about 11, 1130, and we're breaking up in the parking lot there. And you were like, okay, I got to go out and look at like seven properties or something at 11:30 p.m. And you were like on your way back through the city of Chicago to look at the properties for the auction that was taking place the next day. And I realized in my head, I said, oh, well, everybody doesn't go get the brand new nice cars for the simple fact that everybody's not willing to go out there at 11:30 at night and start the next hour and a half tour of several properties that you plan on buying early the next morning. And it really was a highlight, that story I told, to highlight the hard work that you put in, you know, the short time that I've known you and the few examples that you've shared. 500 dials, 100 contacts, 4 to 5 appointments. How many other real estate agents are willing to put in that kind of hard work to get, you know, the results that other people are talking about? And I think it speaks as a testament to that. And I think it's important. I would love, if I were a guru, Andrew, I would love to say this is a get rich quick business and everybody could just real easily. But it's really, you have to work hard and build systems and learn these things and build skills over time. In order to get the kind of success that a lot of those BS gurus would have you believe if you would just buy their package to do that. So, I mean,
yeah, but man, I truly work, believe really. That to go back, I feel that I'm very blessed because, see, I'm just not happy. Normally, with anything normal, I'm not happy. I just can't help myself. You know, and I've been this way since I was a kid, that anything that normal people do, I'm not happy with. And so I can't go to sleep at night, and then I have to figure something else out, you know? And I found that it's a blessing because then I have no other option. I mean, I cannot fail. I mean, just not, that's just not how my brain works. And so somehow it's going to work, and that just, it seems to line up. The more and more I believe that, the more and more things just line up. And I think it took years for that to happen, but it does seem to happen more and more often. That doesn't mean everything we touch turns to gold. I wish it did, but certainly a lot of things line up. And I think it's a philosophy of just a way of thinking. So
True enough. Yeah, you're definitely right in saying that we're blessed with that. Or those of us who may have intentionally installed that belief over the course of time. Andrew, I want to switch gears just a little bit, and we're going to go into some like tactics and some details, I guess, or some of your belief and strategies surrounding rental properties, because I know you have a really special way of looking at and structuring rental portfolios. And I love to have people on our show share their investment when it comes to buying and holding rental property, because I believe that you should know why you're buying these properties and not accidentally buying the wrong properties so that you end up with a problem in the future. Instead, you want to end up with a portfolio that's a solution to your problem and, you know, kind of the answer to the problem or the actual goal manifested. So can you describe your investment philosophy surrounding the acquisition and holding or sale of rental properties?
So basically, I mean, I think in the beginning we touched on that I did flips as a start because I thought that was investing. And after doing that for a couple of years, I realized it was transactions. It was trading properties, not investing, right? Investing to me is something where you acquire an asset, and then you keep it for a long period of time and it grows in value and creates cash flow. That to me is investing. Anything else in my book is trading properties, and you can make a lot of money trading, but I didn't want to be in the trading business. I was in the trading business working for a commission. So, because that came with a lot of stress, which was, oh, what if happens? Properties don't sell. What if you have a bad month, good month, so on and so forth. So philosophy started there. And, so, when we buy rental properties, we tend to, and I'm talking as it relates to Chicago market, I tend to buy all properties in Chicago suburbs, and we classify the markets as A, affluent, B, as bread and butter, C, some challenges in the market, and D, for us, as war zones. So in the suburbs of Chicago, 99.9%, there's no real war zones, obviously. Parts of the city, there are areas where there are war zones. But so we tend to buy property B neighborhoods, solid B neighborhoods, or C, but there may be some challenges, a little bit of crime, but nothing horrendous. So we stick to the B and C markets in the Chicagoland area, and we specifically don't buy anything that is 5, 6, 7 units, 10 units, because the numbers that I want, I can't produce in the markets that I want. And the basic philosophy is that every property that we buy after rehabs needs to have a minimum of 25 to 30% equity net after expenses, conservative appraisals. If it doesn't have, so an ideal example would be is the property is worth $135,000 to $140,000 on a refi appraisal, which is going to be a very conservative appraisal. My all-in cost into that property is $100,000 or less. Plus the property, we never do a 2-year or less lease. So we do minimum 2-year leases, 3 years sometimes, but every time it's a 2-year lease, and it has to cash flow a minimum for single family properties, $400 after all expenses, including management. And, plus, I don't want to have any cash flow left. I mean, any cash left in the property. Once we buy it, acquire it always for cash, either it's borrowed capital or our own capital. And, we rehab it, we refinance it with a commercial loan. And then, it has minimum of 25 to 30% equity minimum, and minimum it'll cash flow. If it's a single family, $400 minimum. If it's, 2-unit, it'll minimum have a cash flow of $800. If it's a 3-unit, it'll have a minimum cash flow of $1,100. And so if you look at 98% of all the properties that I have in the portfolio of 185, 190, whatever the properties are right now that we have performing, will fit that criteria. So we have 4 or 5 properties where I have money stuck in those properties. They produce huge cash flow, but to me, it's a bad investment. Not that it's a bad investment. It makes 40-50% cash on cash return, but I call it a bad investment because I think I can do better. So to me, it's a bad investment. That's a philosophical kind of way of thinking. And the other thing is that all the cash flow that we produce every month since 2011, I've never touched a penny of it ever. All of it goes back to buying more rental properties, or all of it goes back to paying off the rental properties that we have in the portfolio.
That is interesting. I really like the amounts of cash flow and some of the equity positions. A lot of these would be bought on flip numbers, Andrew. How
they're all bought on flip numbers. Actually, that's a very good observation.
Okay. All right. How hard is it, or has it gotten harder in here we are in May 2018 going into June. Has it gotten harder to find deals? And if so, what have your sources of deals been of late that maybe were not the same 5 years ago?
It is harder to acquire, obviously. I mean, but I think it's a two-way street, right? When it's like with flips. When it's hard to buy, it's easy to sell. When it's easy to buy, it's hard to sell. You know, same thing with rentals. When it was very easy to acquire, the back end refis were very, very tough every time we're pulling teeth. Even when we had very conservative numbers, you know. So we buy a lot of Cook County, which is the toughest auctions in our area, which is one of the toughest places to buy in the country, because very competitive, almost no info. You really have to be on top of what you're doing. Obviously, we'll buy all the other counties, but relative to Cook County, all the other county auctions are much easier to buy. But so I've been buying over there since 2010. So that's about 35% of our inventory comes from there. 35 to 40% still comes from auctions. And then some of the inventory comes from off market. We do not buy as much inventory off market. And I think if one mistake I have made, which I admire you for what you do, which is you do a lot of marketing from what I hear from, and you do a lot of off market stuff. If I truly did off market going after properties, the type of properties you go after, my numbers would be even more ridiculously better. I mean, one thing I've always taken pride in is that, that the quality of properties I will buy is very, very, very high. And I still believe in the best of markets. For a person like me, so a year will touch about 150 properties. Most of them will pass it on to the people in the RIA without any profit. We just give those away. There's no profit in it for us. Some of them, obviously, we will wholesale. Some of them will flip, but we're looking to keep 30, 40 good quality properties for rentals. And in a market like Chicago with 9 million people, MLS has 250,000 transactions. There's 50,000 transactions that are off MLS transactions. All I'm looking for, man, is 30, 40 great rentals a year. And if I can't find that, shame on me.
What is your end game? Is there a number that you're trying to hit? Will you eventually sell these? What does this all lead to, Andrew?
Man, I want to buy a jet. So, and that would cost me about $300,000 to $350,000 a year to keep. To buy a jet is not that expensive, about $5 million starting out, 10 to 15 on the mid range, I guess, and then sky's the limit. But to me, so a lot of people are like, well, this guy is crazy, but I have a kind of a weird philosophy behind it. For me to get to a stage where I can buy that, the amount of net worth and the amount of business I have to be able to have that as a fun expense, I have to have a great business by my standards for me to spend that kind of money. So, and that's what kind of my goal is. My goal is net 100,000 a month from cash flow, not from earned income. And then I should not have to touch that income. So every penny we spend is earned income is what we spend. We don't spend a penny of rental income. But I want to have that because to me, that's ultimate security.
Nice. So, Andrew, if I ask you, what is your highest value skill set? How would you answer that?
Highest value skill set is to be able to understand what is investing and what is trading.
Do you think there's a difference early on? So if you met somebody who's at your RIA event, let's say they maybe did one or two deals, or maybe they did no deals, but they're certainly not picking up 35, 40 properties per year. what would you tell them they should focus on to develop as their high value skill set?
I think the one skill set that you have to have in real estate is understanding property values and what is a good deal versus what is just a average deal. The somebody to say, oh my God, I got a great deal. That's man, one in a thousand. So the best way to learn personally, I feel, is if you take any zip code and take the bottom 40% of that market and look at 100, 200 houses in that market and then start putting numbers to it. If you want to do flips, then put flip numbers. If you want to do wholesale margins, then you can do wholesales or rentals. I mean, and a lot of times, I mean, I started in 2008. So January 14th, 2008 is when I bought my first flip. It was a market which was terrible, and I had thought about buying flips since I was like 19 years old. And so the standards that I had laid out for myself were kind of crazy, and they've gotten crazier because my sole investment in real estate since I started was a $22,000 investment in from a home equity loan on my own house. And I just didn't have the bandwidth to afford to lose money, you know. So it was kind of, and I had talked a couple of my friends into putting $20,000 also. And these are people that I respected. And it was kind of thing that I didn't want to let them down. So my deal with them was that, hey, if we ever lose money, I lose my $20,000 first before they lost a penny. And they thought I was nuts. But literally, the first 4.5-5 years of my business, even doing flips, I never lost one dime ever. There were properties, obviously, I didn't make money on. But I was like so paranoid of losing money that I passed up deals like it was going out of style. And I truly believe that one skill set that has helped me is I'm a long-term optimist and a dreamer and a short-term paranoid personality. So I tend to be, in 99.9% of things, way more careful than most people are.
Yeah, I think that's a great combination of qualities there. And I remember back in the very beginning, I have done a few deals where our losses did not, you know, exceed maybe $1,500 or something like that, where we just missed the mark a little bit, had to sell the property. Luckily, got out with a very, very small loss. But I always am of the fact or of the mindset of paying off the lenders and partners. And if this was my deal and I put my stamp on it, then, you know, damn it, I better be willing to lose the money or my chunk just like you are. So I think that we share that same value in other people's money and protecting that, not walking away from it. Talking about understanding property values versus, you know, and finding real deals as a number one skill, couldn't say it was a much higher skill set that I could come up with. In fact, I mean, you know, early in the business, I always found that wholesaling was like a great apprenticeship into the business and being able to find deals that were so good that someone else would pay you a little bit or even a lot of money to step into your shoes will teach you whether or not you have a real deal. Nobody wants to buy the deal. You must have missed the mark. So it's been definitely finding real deals for me is definitely a high value skill set. Andrew, what's your day-to-day contribution to your business now?
But honestly, nowadays, so we have two people that are, well, actually one part-time, one full-time. They both manage the rent collections, showing the properties for us. I have one guy who schedules all the flip rehabs as well as the fixes on the rental properties, and I have a business partner. He takes care of all the loans, all the payments, all the day-to-day operations running the business. I mean, nowadays, the only real thing I really do in the business is just decide if I'm going to buy a property. I mean, and what price, the few flips that we do for the year on those, what I'm going to sell it for, and that's on that side of the business, that's really buying more properties and making sure that the numbers are what they are. On the flip side of it, making sure the numbers are what they are, really all I pay attention to. And that's pretty much it. Because a lot of my time nowadays goes into Chicago REIA meetings, and then the radio show, the bunch of other stuff, that's kind of, so a lot of my time is spent those places rather than necessarily looking at properties. But because we have a fairly developed system now, it's not as obviously as much time that I have to put in necessarily.
Got it. So you guys do some internal management. What are your best tenant sources for those A or those B and C plus properties that you buy?
So tenants wise, you said tenants, right? Rentals?
Yep, finding the best tenants.
We tend to, so my business partner handles that part of it, but he tends to believe that the best tenants come from basic, like Zillow rentals, at least in today's market. You know, so he always puts it there and a bunch of websites, not even on the MLS for the first 2 weeks. He believes that people who tend to go to real estate agents a lot of the times for rentals, their credit in general is not as good. Obviously, the property is not rented within the first 2.5 to 3 weeks, I believe. He puts it on the MLS at that point. And that's where we get, and a lot of rentals are good with the neighbors. I mean, neighbors know somebody and they have somebody move in. A lot of times, just a sign in the yard does the trick. And we get close to about 76% renewal rate on our properties from tenants, because we make sure that they are going to sign a minimum 2-year lease. And so most of the tenants we have, there's not a lot of turnover. I mean, that's been one of my big things, that I don't want turnover. So I was fortunate from a certain extent that from the age of 19 to 20 years old, I had seen a ton of mistakes that real estate investors make. And I kept kind of revising how I thought I would invest the day I would be able to. And all those things I was able to start putting into practice with flips, with rentals. A lot of the stuff, the way I look at the business is, people are like, this is kind of crazy. Why wouldn't you live on the money that you have? Why wouldn't you? I mean, I'm like, I just don't. I mean, it's like same thing with commission checks. I always used to take pride in not cashing commission checks, and I would put them all over the office, and it used to irritate the hell out of other agents in the office that would pass by. I mean, I never said anything to them, but to me, that was like, if I don't have to cash the check, that meant security. That meant that I have some money in the bank. I mean, it's kind of a weird way of thinking, but to me, that was, I felt confident my office that I worked for wasn't going out of business, and it would create problems after 6 months with the accounting department, because they're, hey, we got to close this year's books. But for me, internally, in my head, it was a moment of pride, because I never had for a long time that extra money where I could, I don't know if that makes any sense, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, to take it to the extreme, you're obviously not living in the street and at $0. So is it the couple flips, or what is your source of living expense money these days?
Today, so we do, you know, we do, I think, about 26 to 30 flips a year, right? It's down from the numbers that at one point I had built it up to. But if they're easy flips, then we do them. I mean, if there's a $30,000 profit and it's a $30,000 to $40,000 rehab, then we'll do them. If there's any more rehab, we just pass. Kind of give people an idea to put it in dollar volume, right? That way it kind of makes... So for us, with the employees, with the REIA, with the, all the stuff that we have today, it probably costs us close to about $230,000, $240,000 to run our office, right? Car expenses, insurances, liability insurances, umbrella coverages, all that kind of stuff. Plus personal, a little bit of salary that I pay myself, my business partner pays itself. You know, it costs about $250,000 or so, $260,000. So whatever that cost is what we're trying to recover, and more money to buy more rentals, besides the cash flow from doing flips. I mean, that's the only goal, with the flips that we do. So it makes more money, but that's really the nut we have to cover. I mean, we don't have a lot of personal debt. I don't have much personal debt anymore. My business partner doesn't have hardly any personal debt. So our mortgages are low. A lot of the business expenses are paid through the business. So we run the business kind of a little bit differently, you know, that most people do. So.
Cool. So I have another question that I'd like you to answer two ways. Andrew, first, what are one or two book recommendations you would make to somebody just getting started? And second, what would be one or two book recommendations you'd make to somebody already successful in their real estate career?
I think the one book that this is not a real estate book, but it's a book on investing, which I find I read early on, and I've gone back and read it a few different times, because a lot of my philosophy is from the Warren Buffett school of thought of doing things. And there's a book written by the guy who taught, one of the people that Warren Buffett credits, is it's called his name was Benjamin Graham, and it's called The Intelligent Investor. And the book is not about real estate. The book is about portfolio analysis and understanding in what is investing truly at its core. So to me, that's one of the great books. Another book that was written by Gary Keller, which I'm sure your earlier guest probably brought up, was The One Thing. That was a book that was written by Gary Keller from Keller Williams. And it's purely about focus. So those are two big books that I would think. And there's a couple other books on, I tend to enjoy more biographies, more from a lot of people who are very, very high producers and in productive in terms of their lives. But a lot of times what it does is it gives you background on how humble a lot of people who we would consider mega successful, where they came from, all the hardships that they went through. I just recently read an audio, heard an audiobook by the guy, Phil, whatever his name is, from Nike, you know, and building Nike, the amount of hell he went through. A lot of times what it does is it makes you realize that it doesn't matter how bad things may be for you at a certain point in your life, there's a lot of, we're a lot more blessed than a lot of the people that have gone through a lot worse things. And yet, if they can overcome their odds, I think we can probably, you know, live another day, I guess.
Nice. Andrew, if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with your 19-year-old self as you were taking that Pell Grant and investing it in real estate information, what would that be?
Man, that's a good, very good question. I think somebody once said that wisdom is the principal thing. And it's not about money. It's not about success. It's not about anything. It's about wisdom. And how do you gain wisdom? You gain wisdom with experiences. And how do you have experience? Experience is through a lot of mistakes. If one thing I would say is don't take a shortcut. At times, I tried to shortcut things. Every time I have done that, it comes back to bite me. And pick one thing and then stick to the damn one thing. Because there are people who are wonderfully successful in doing all sorts of various things. But grass is not necessarily greener on your neighbor's lawn. If once in a while you do feel that the grass is greener on the neighbor's lawn, maybe walk over and look back at your own lawn, because a lot of times we find that our own lawn is a lot cleaner, greener. It's just you're looking at it from a different angle.
Nice. Well said. I remember in my time of trial and tribulation back then in 2010, 11, 12, when I was having burnt grass in my life and having to start over, I remember reading in the Bible, it said, wisdom is more valuable than rubies and gold. It says that in the book of Proverbs. And, you know, for you to highlight that and point that out, I remember when I changed my mindset to that, and then I became, you know, I was hungry for the wisdom, the knowledge, trying to find how things were done, the things that were important, things to pay attention to, as opposed to, you know, just finding my next deal for the sake of money. And I made it a point, a determination. I said, you know what? I don't like the way things are. This is back in 2010 or 11. I said, I'm going to figure out how to fertilize this grass of mine so that when people look at my lawn, they think, damn, he's got the greenest grass out there.
Right. No, it's just so true. And then, listen, it's like, I think every 2, 3, 5 years we grow, and hopefully we'll all of us have our own stupidities. All of us have things that you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that, right? And I think there are two types of people. There are people who just keep repeating the stupidities, and then there are people who learn from them and move on with life. Hopefully those stupidities aren't such that you can't really, you know, go back from them, but it's like, it's just one of those things. You realize that it is what it is and you just move on, because life doesn't give a damn and life doesn't judge you. It's just that the people around you judge you, and nobody wants to get on a train that's not moving. As soon as your train starts moving at a rapid pace, every son of a gun who doubted you will be, oh my God, that obviously worked. And then if you just start moving way too fast, then, oh my God, he must be doing something wrong. It's like, dude, I'm just trying to put one foot in front of the other, man. I'm not, you know, I don't take anything from you. I want nothing from you. But, and so you meet all types, but you realize the better you do at anything, that's just how it is. I mean, that's just, and that used to bother me for a long time, because people will say stuff and I'm like, I've taken pride in doing things the right way. And that bothered me sometimes. And people say stuff, but we all need shit to say. So people say stuff that doesn't mean anything, you know? So it's just, you got to move on.
Yeah, true enough. Andrew, do you want to share some information about how people can find out more about you, websites, maybe the radio call, et cetera?
Sure. I mean, they can always reach us at Chicago REIA. That's Chicago, and REIA, R-E-I-A. That's Chicago Real Estate Investors Association. So the email for that, or the website, is chicagoreia.org. And the email is info@chicagoreia.org. So.
Cool. I really appreciate you taking time out. It was challenging for you and me both to get together and clear our schedules and get this done for everybody in the audience here at the REI Diamond Show. I thank you for that, and I appreciate you, especially sharing some of the behind-the-scenes thoughts of Andrew Holmes, the hard work and, you know, the tornado fury that must have been 500 dials, 100 contacts, et cetera, you know, multiplied out by all these years to give us, you know, to give us all this wisdom that you shared here today. So I thank you for coming on the show, Andrew.
Oh, thank you. It's been a privilege for you to have me on. And I've listened to your podcast over time. And one thing I've realized is that your way of asking questions, digging for depth, and trying to get the real meat and potatoes rather than, oh, I was here broke and now everything is great, you know, and look at what I got. I think I like the approach that you take always. First, I think, interview I ever heard was Joe Mueller's interview on your podcast. And so I'm very grateful, and thank you so much. Wish a lot of success, not only to all the things. I know you guys are growing like crazy also. So thank you so much again, and we'll talk to everybody soon.
And thank you, my loyal listener, for checking out this, the 103rd episode of the REI Diamond Show. If you are interested in checking out the next episode pre-released before the email goes out, please subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. If you would like a copy, a PDF download instantly of my book on wholesaling, all 164 pages of Become a Wholesale Real Estate Master, go to reidiamonds.com and enter your email address. Once you confirm the email address, you'll receive a second email containing the download link for near instant access to that book, which is pretty much the business plan I use to build Diamond Equity Investments up to the machine, which is now doing between 40 and 50 deals per month. If you have investment capital sitting on the sidelines, not already earning above average returns, you should go check out superchargedreturns.com. When you enter your email address there, I'll send you periodic emails when the next upcoming private mortgage investment opportunities become available in Chicago, Atlanta, Florida, and Philadelphia. Those private mortgage investments are used to fund my fix and flip projects, as well as some short-term 90 days or less wholesale deals where investors receive their capital back in a shorter period of time. If you want to check that out, again, the site is superchargedreturns.com. And finally, last but not least, if you have certain questions or topics you would like discussed on a future episode, or if you have a guest suggestion, somebody that you'd like me to reach out and invite on the show, You can contact me by clicking on the Contact Dan link at reidiamonds.com. I do personally monitor those form submissions at that site. And you can also check out profitable real estate deals we may have available in each of those markets as well from that site. Again, reidiamonds.com. Thank you once again for being a loyal listener of the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.